me. Well, now I know that she loves me, but she won't say yes to me. Well, now I love my baby, I got the boogie boogie blue. Well, I boogie this morning, I boogie last night. I woke up this morning and I didn't feel right. I got the boogie boogie blues, boogie boogie blues. Oh Lord, got the boogie boogie blues. Well, I boogie boogie blues because my baby just don't give me right. Well, I went to my baby, said you love me, honey. She said you got the time. Got the honey boogie boogie blues, boogie boogie blues. Oh Lord, I got the boogie boogie blues. Well, I boogie boogie blues because my baby just don't give me right.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, and that's Charlie Gracie. In fact, that's the first record he ever recorded, 1953 on Cadillac. And it was the start of an amazing career all the way around, and a surprising one on many levels, too. And sadly, when he died last month, I was just crushed, and I heard from Charlie Jr., who said, you know, maybe after the holidays, let's do a thing on my dad. And I said, absolutely, I would love that. And in fact, I do. So we will welcome Charlie Gracie Jr. to WGN Radio. Hey, Charlie. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, yes. Raleigh, thank you for having me on. First of all, it's a great treat to speak with you again. It's been a while.
Too long.
Ever since you left Philadelphia, was it maybe 2003, something like that, was it? Am I right?
I think it was 2006.
Okay, later. Well, we haven't been the same. We've been all the poorer, not only because of your great knowledge of music, but also your perspective on all things politics, things political.
Yeah, although any more with my blood pressure and everything else, I try to just leave that off the air.
I hear you. Absolutely.
But so this is real bittersweet for me because, of course, I love talking about your dad, but I hate the reason at the moment. And I wanted to start it out with the first record he ever recorded. I guess it was certainly the first I knew about on Cadillac. Was that the first?
Yeah, that record was recorded actually in 1951. My father wasn't quite 16 years of age. He was in junior high school, about to go into high school.
Wow.
I think it was released maybe the following year. He performed it on Bob Horn's Bandstand and the Paul Whiteman Show, which led to sort of a regional break for him, you know, got him on more television radio programs, and it was a start. My father's first manager, Graham Prince, who was out of Charlotte, North Carolina, was driving to the Philadelphia area and heard my father perform on the Paul Whiteman Show, which was simulcast on radio and television. He said, this kid's got something, you know, and my father got a telegram a day or two later from Mr. Prince saying, you know, I'd like to be your manager. I think you got some potential. And that was kind of the beginning. But there weren't too many white artists, you know, maybe outside of Bill Haley, who was doing stuff with the Saddlemen, doing kind of country boogie-woogie in the late 40s and early 50s. Outside of my dad and Bill Haley, there weren't so many white guys playing that kind of music in that style. You know?
No, and that's the interesting thing on Bandstand, which, of course, was a Bob Horn creation, though Dick Clark never liked to admit it. But nonetheless, it was a tough time because when he started in 52, of course, they just wanted to fill time because there was no network programming around the clock. And really, when you think about it, when you talk about the quote-unquote white artists, you're talking the heart of pop standards. I mean, 52 is Joe Stafford and Joni James and on the list is. So it was tough. And here was Bob Horn, who made it until they set him up and threw him out about 5 years later. But he managed to go from the pop standard era to decidedly rock and roll without losing a kid. And I don't think there was anybody else who could have pulled that off.
Well, you know, when people interview me about my dad and various articles, this has come up occasionally that, you know, my dad was in the studio experimenting with this kind of music, you know, country swing, boogie woogie, rhythm and blues, you know, long before Elvis and Buddy Holly and Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent had ever set foot inside a studio. I'll even add the Jerry Lee Lewis to that too.
And not
taking anything away from those artists. They were all great. And we just lost Jerry Lee a few months ago, of course, too, and they were calling him the last man standing. But I beg to differ. I think Charlie Gracie was the last man standing because, you know, Jerry Lee probably hadn't given a great performance in 10 or 15 years. My dad was still out there, you know, kicking butt, if you give the expression. Up until the weekend, he got sick. My father was playing two shows. He played a show up in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, at an old theater. with Little Peggy March, Brian Hyland, Chris Montez, the Duprees, and a few other artists. And then we had to drive to New York City the next night for a similar concert, pretty much the same lineup with a few, you know, others. And a couple thousand people at each concert. I'm kind of glad my dad got to go out with larger venues. You know, my father wasn't afraid to play. You know, he played theaters. He played music festivals over in Europe all the time. But he wasn't ashamed to play a bar or a tap room or an Irish pub. He just loved to play, whether it's 50 people or 2,000. He just loved to play. He lived for that.
Yes.
So he did those concerts. It was April 23rd and 24th, and on the 26th, he was in the hospital with COVID and multiple kidney infections. And he had several throughout the spring and summer. And every time he had an episode, Raleigh, he came out weaker each time, and was never in any pain, but it sucked the life out of him. He was maybe 35% of what he was before. And it was shocking to see my father, who had always had so much energy, so much drive and stamina. So he sort of resigned himself. He did say about maybe 3 months into this, well, I'll probably never play again. And we said, Dad, don't give up. You know, my mom tried to fatten him up with her Italian dishes and what have you, but he lost his appetite. And, you know, if you're not eating, you know, food is life. And if you're not eating, your body begins to, get weaker and wane. And, by November, December, he was really down to about maybe 98 pounds.
Oh man.
And, We put him in a Catholic nursing facility nearby us in a wonderful place called Little Flower Manor, and they took very good care of him. And again, he was coherent. He was conscious. Yeah. He was conversing and trying to slip the nurses and doctors the $10 bills because they were taking such good care of him. We can't take your money. We're not allowed. He's like, well, I want to do something nice for you. But they told us eventually that his body was going to give out. Surely enough, it did. And we were all by his side on December 16th when he breathed his last breath. And he was conscious up until about the day before.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking. You know, he was the light of our lives.
Absolutely.
He had such a resurgence the last 20 years or so. It's been amazing. Ride.
And we're gonna talk about that next hour right here. So don't go away. Stay just where you are. We're talking to Charlie Gracie Jr. And, of course, the life and times of Charlie Gracie on WGN Radio.
You tell me you love me, you say you're true, then you fly around with somebody new, but I'm crazy about you, you butterfly. You're treating me mean, you're making me cry. I made up my mind to tell you goodbye, but I'm no good without you, you butterfly. Tasted them out of my mouth. I love you so much, I know what I'll do. I'm flipping your wings, you fly in this blue, cause I'm crazy about you, you butterfly.
WGN Radio, I'm Raleigh James, and well, undoubtedly you know Butterfly, but I'll tell you what, if there wasn't Butterfly, you would not know Cameo Parkway Records. That's a given. We're talking about the guy who made Cameo possible, and that's not an exaggeration, and we're doing that with his son, Charlie Gracie Jr., on WGN Radio, and I'm going to hog you a while longer, but then maybe we will take some calls. But Charlie, before we get to Cameo, I wanted to talk a moment about Cadillac, because, you know, there was a documentary on Chess Records they called Cadillac Records. And when you start to look up Cadillac, that's all you see is this documentary. And I know it was a little label out of Detroit, and they had a half a dozen people. And it's so funny with the three releases by your dad. One they spell it G-R-A-C-I, and then G-R-A-C-Y. They weren't really, and then finally G-R-A-C-I-E. They weren't really sure what they're going to do with that. But how did a South Philly boy wind up on Cadillac Records, an unknown label out of Detroit?
Well, again, that gentleman I mentioned to you earlier, Graham Prince out of Charlotte, North Carolina, got my father signed to that label. It was located on Broadway, Cadillac Records. Again, no connection to the one in Detroit and the one that the movie kind of, you know, put a spotlight on a few years back. But my dad did, I think, as you say, three releases or a few unreleased things that came out later. And G-R-A-C-I, of course, is the original spelling. My father was a second-generation Sicilian-American. Grew up in a little row house, 900 square feet in South Philadelphia on Pier Street.
Uh-huh.
It's really the heart of South Philadelphia, about as south as you can get before you hit the river,
right.
The Delaware River. And my grandparents, my grandfather was into jazz and being band and a lot of the black music. And my grandmother, who was raised actually up in Pittston, Pennsylvania, in the coal mine region, was exposed to a lot of country music. So my father had a healthy exposure to all these different styles. As he used to say, all this stuff was kind of like swirling around in my head. And really, it wasn't my father's idea to go into show business. My grandfather always wanted to be in show business himself, but growing up during the Great Depression, and that was impossible. You had to go to work and put bread on the table, so show business was almost laughable. Like, what show business? You know, impossible.
Yeah.
Get a job in a factory. We need to eat. Hmm. So my grandfather swore that when he got married, that his first son or daughter that would come along, he would try to instill that love of music and show business in them. And my dad just kind of took to it. He took my dad down to South Street, which is a song was made famous by the Orlines, yeah. Where all the hippies meet. South Street was a pawn in the haberdashery area in Philadelphia. It's still kind of a trendy spot to visit,
yeah.
Today. And my grandfather said, I want you to pick an instrument out and make something of yourself. I don't want you to work like a jackass like I have all my life. My grandfather worked in the Stetson hat factory, you know.
Mm.
And my dad said, how about a trumpet, Dad? And my grandfather said, no, you'll blow your brains out. He goes, get a guitar. It'll be a one-man band. What foresight he had, because
yeah.
This is 1946 now. Within, 8 to 10 years, the guitar became the most popular instrument in the world. It still is to this
sure.
day.
Sure.
So and my father took to the instrument. He had some. My grandfather taught him a few chords. My grandfather played around with the instrument a little bit and then hired a professional teacher for him. And after 5 or 6 years, the teacher said, hey, look, you know, you play better than me now. You're on your own, kid. So,
yeah.
You know, after winning several amateur contests and being on the Paul Whiteman show. And by the way, Bernie Lowe, who actually founded Cameo Records, was a pianist, a great piano player.
Yes.
He went out as Dizzy Brown in the 1930s and played a lot of the bars and clubs and what have you on his own. And he played in the Paul Whiteman Orchestra. So when Bernie started Cameo Records in late 56, Elvis had already hit. And he was looking for someone to kind of, you know, fit that vein, and I remembered my dad from the show and knew that he had talent. My dad was bouncing around locally, playing a lot of bars and tap rooms and strip clubs and things of that nature.
Sure.
And Bernie Lowe borrowed $2,000 from his brother-in-law, who had a trucking company, and came to my father's home in South Philadelphia with a little tape recorder and had Butterfly in 99 Ways on the tape recorder. Said, look, these are the songs I want you to record. I want to sign you to my label. I think you have a lot of talent. That was December 30th of 1956.
Mm-hmm.
They went into Recco Art Studio and recorded that thing, 12th and Market Street. As a matter
right.
of fact, Raleigh, we had a memorial service for my dad last Friday on the 30th, so it would have been a 66th anniversary
of that
recording. Yeah, and then by March, it was the number one record in the country, and Andy Williams also covered it and hit number one. So this is a blockbuster hit in 57. You know, two number ones on one song.
Well,
unheard of, but it happened.
It did, and it's a fascinating story, of course, because Bernie Lowe, along with Cal Mann, wrote it, as you so very well
yeah.
know. But when you look
Absolutely.
At when you look at the release on Cameo, or even the Andy Williams release on Cadence, you'll see that
yeah.
Anthony September wrote it. And
yeah.
and of course, this is
a pseudonym
for Tony Mamarella, yeah.
who was Dick Clark's producer,
right?
Yeah.
And for a moment, was actually host of Bandstand between them
yeah.
ousting Horn and putting Clark in. But and in fact, as you probably
sure.
well know, at the Paola hearings, when Lishman was questioning Bernie Lowe, he asked exactly what this was about and the purpose of the payments, and didn't Tony Mamarella copyright the song under the name Anthony September? Yes. And then didn't he assign that copyright back to you? Yes. And of course, as you well know, this is how they intrigued Dick Clark into breaking this
yes.
record. And of
yeah,
course,
Dick, yeah.
You know, Bernie Lowe at this point, like you say, he's basically a musician of sorts, and the
uh-huh.
big band era has come to a close. He doesn't know what he's going to do. Gee, maybe he'll start this little record label. And of course, the first couple things they released went utterly nowhere. And then,
right.
you know, Butterfly, I guess they figured, well, we need to really sweeten the pot for Dick. Now, was your father even aware of any of that at that point?
No, he had no idea. It later came to light during the Paola hearing
yeah.
that Dick Clark collected $14,000 in writer's royalties and publishing royalties on that song.
Right.
And Bernie Lowe claimed it. Well, I wanted to, you know, because Dick Clark was so good to them that, you know, come on, Dick, you know, like, here's your piece of the pie. And
right.
Dick was like, oh, no, Bernard,
yeah.
You know, that's quite all right. But, you know, but, oh, okay, I'll take it anyway.
Yeah, right, so, right, man.
And this went on in the 50s. This was a common practice back then, and it is a form of payola. Let's face it; it is.
Well, and it was legal. It was not legal.
And
for,
it was.
Yeah, it was not legal for a licensee to take the money, but it was absolutely legal for an employee to take the money. So it might have been underhanded, or you might talk about commercial bribery. But as for payola, it was not illegal. But what certainly was illegal on any level is, in fact, not paying royalties to the artist. And here's where we get into your dad. So he's got this number one record, and of course, Butterfly becomes ubiquitous, whether it's Charlie Gracie at number one, or, you know, or whether it's Andy Williams. And even when Andy Williams was at number one, Charlie Gracie is still at number eight. So it's doing very well. And did your dad get anything before he started questioning it?
I believe he got about $5,000 from the company, and that was pretty much it. And he was promised 2 cents a record. I think Butterfly went on to sell about 2.5 million copies.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, you can do the math, and you can see how much money he was owed. But and then, of course, you know, 99 Ways, the flip side, also reached number 11, and that was powered by another version by the actor Tab Hunter, who couldn't sing his way out of a paper bag, but he was handsome and was hot at the time, and he covered it. So, you know, Butterfly was only powered by three major records, and then there were other, Billy Williams and a few others covered it as well, lesser known artists, but it was a big record. And then Fabulous made number 16. My dad's follow-up, Fabulous, went to 16, here number 8 in the UK, and that sold about 600,000 or 700,000. So there were, and Wonder and I, Love You So Much at Hearst, was a two-sided hit for him in Britain. So, you know, he was making money, you know, here and overseas as well. So what happened was my dad's manager at that time, Bernie Rothbard, said, well, look, you know, obviously they're jilting you out of your royalty. So I have offers for you to play overseas, Charlie, you know, with England. Like they want you to come over and do an extensive tour. My dad's like, wow, you know, the land of my dreams. I heard about Britain in the history books, and sure, I'd love to go. And apparently Cameo was not happy with the fact that my dad was booked overseas, and Bernie Rothbard tried to explain to Bernie, well, you know, this kid's hot. Where's he going to make this kind of money? My dad was making like $3,000 or $4,000 a week, you know, headlining the hippodromes and the palladiums and places like that all throughout the provinces. So he went over, and apparently Cameo was not happy with the fact that my father went overseas, but they shouldn't have been, because his records were also selling in the UK. My father had, I think, five top 20 records in the UK in 57 and 58. They were reaching, you know, the higher rungs on the pop chart ladder. So, you know, they were making money on both sides of the fence. Both
now,
sides of the pond,
was Cameo licensing those records, where they were getting a piece of it when they sold in Great Britain?
Yeah, I think Parlophone carried Butterfly and 99 Ways, and then they switched over to London Records for like Wonder and Eyes, I Love You So Much at Hearst, and Fabulous.
But the bottom line is Cameo was getting money. And we should also also point out, not only was Cameo basically not a label before Butterfly hit, but when you're an independent little label, you got no distribution. So what Butterfly gave Cameo was the right to get good distribution, because there was a hit, and other hits were coming, like Fabulous. So they actually got paid, which was something brand new to them.
Right, right. So. Yeah, Loa Man also penned Teddy Bear for Elvis, as a matter of fact, and Remember Your Mind for Pat Boone, two other giant records that year in 57, I believe it was. Yeah, so they were doing very well.
They were. And you know what's interesting, since it is absolutely proven beyond a doubt that they were stiffing your dad, you would think that they would be thrilled he was going to Great Britain, because it's like, oh yeah, let the kid make money there. But they didn't.
Well, that was the only way you could, you know, I mean, a lot of the artists, it's nothing new. I mean, some of them, and then the black artists made even less, or give them a couple $100 of buying them maybe a couple new suits and maybe a brand new Chevy or something like that. And that was considered the royalty. But, you know, I mean, you can't live on that. But, so, I mean, the artists would make their royalties or make their money on personal appearances. So, yeah, my dad went ahead with that and did it. And, you know, in the long run, thank God he went overseas, because when he got blacklisted after suing Cameo in early 58, you know, he kind of, the door was slammed shut on him for a number of years, and he went from the bottom to the top, back to the bottom again, and had to start pretty much all over again.
Oh, yeah.
But England was his salvation, because he was able to go back there again. But with the revival of the 50s and the late 70s, he went back and made over 40, we counted, at least my mom and I counted over 40 tours between 79 and 2019. Yeah, of course, the pandemic killed 2020 and 2021.
Well,
he was actually booked to go over there, but couldn't go.
Yeah,
you know, everything was shut down. But the last tour he made, Raleigh, was a 26-city tour in May and June of 2019 in England. It was quite a really, looking back now, it was wonderful that he did that, because he really got around that summer. Then he came home for a week and then went to Belgium
for a week and played there.
Just
terrific.
And it's just amazing. They love that music. They love roots music over there.
So in 58, here's early 58. Now we have a few hits under our belt, and we know without a doubt these records are selling literally in the millions, and your dad's getting nothing.
Right.
And was it his manager who said, we got to sue him, or did he come up with this concept? Or who
Actually, no. My grandfather, who sort of acted as my dad's road manager, and again, he was a working man, a blue-collar worker. He knew nothing about show business. My dad was 20, 21. What did he know? He was green.
Yeah.
And my grandfather said, you know, we should ask to see the books. And of course, they kept two sets of books, and they were offended. The company was offended when my dad asked, like, you know, where's the royalties? He's like, well, you know, we signed contracts, And Bernie said to my dad, well, look, let's not discuss it. We'll let our lawyers handle it. And my dad's like, whoa, you know, you came to my house with a few bucks in your pocket, started this record company, and we all began together in good faith. And now, you know, we can't talk man to man. We're going to let our lawyers discuss it. So my dad knew right then and there that, well, it's probably over. And I think they did settle out of court for $50,000. And in May of 58, and then my dad went on to record for Carl and Roulette.
Right.
I mean, he had talent, so the label still wanted to sign him, and he was still working, but it was hard to get airplay after that. You know,
well,
the door was slammed shut, and then the Paola scandal broke in 59, and so that was like, wow, anybody who questioned, you know, the operation was kept it far at arm's length, you know, far, far away.
We're gonna pick it up there in 58 and go to Coral and then to Roulette. And I got a zillion questions, you know. I thought I knew everything, but when I was looking over these records, I said, nope, Charlie Jr. can fill in the blanks. And he will right here on WGN Radio. WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, and yes, that is Charlie Gracie. It's Angel of Love, 1959, on Carl. Now, what do we know about Carl? Well, we normally think about them as your Lawrence Welk label, or Don Cornell, or Eileen Barton, or the McGuire sisters, but also, as of 1957, Buddy Holly. Yeah, Peggy Sue, and Ray Vaughan, and Words of Love. All right, so what happens in early 59? I don't have to tell you about the day the music dies. So what comes up next? We need somebody to replace him. And here comes Charlie Gracie. And I thought Angel of Love shoulda. It's a woulda, coulda, shoulda. So that's where we will pick it up. We're talking to Charlie Gracie Jr. about the life and times of Charlie Gracie Sr. And what an amazing career. More in moments on WGN Radio.
Come on, baby. You and me, long black hair. Let's have a party. A high five. progressive jazz, what a gas. Oh, baby. You drive me out of my mood. Mine.
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, and that is Charlie Gracie. And 1961 on Felstead. And I admit it, I always figured Felstead was, you know, some guy named Felstead in Philly or something. But no, it was a neighborhood in Great Britain, and it was British Decca that had the label, primarily to release American stuff. So one of those pieces of stuff was a wow. That was the name of it, Wow, by Charlie Gracie. And it always makes me smile, and I bet it does you too, Charlie Jr.
It does. They were fooling around in the studio one day. My dad always liked to kind of horse around doing Porky Pig, and I guess the A&R man said, hey, let's cut something along the lines of that, and they went with it. And, you know, it's funny, my dad actually went to see Dick Clark in 61. Yeah. Because novelty records were pretty big in the early 60s. There's a whole list of them, and Clark said, yeah, Charlie, nice job, but, you know, we can't play this. And he's like, well, why? You know, he said, because it might offend people who stutter.
Oh,
and my dad said, Dick, Porky Pig has been a star for 30 years. Like what are you talking about? He said, well, he was, of course, he was looking for an excuse just to.
Yeah,
there was
just no way. Yeah, your father could have recorded the number one record of all time, and Dick Clark wouldn't have been playing it. You know,
but it's a fun record. I'm glad
it is a fun record. Yeah,
it is.
Yeah,
did all kinds of stuff.
And you never hear it anymore. And you were, of course, a toddler when that came out. So
I was. Yeah.
I'm sure you enjoyed it immensely.
Oh, I did. My father would fool around the house and do the Porky Pig thing for us. You know, amongst the family, family dinners and what have you. Always got a kick out of it. So yeah, he tried something out of the box. Yeah, you know, that time around. But you know, by 61, he had toured England twice, and
right.
And everything was very successful over there. And you know, I remember he was the first solo American artist to tour the United Kingdom extensively. Bill Haley went over with his band, but my father went over as a solo act.
Right.
And he had a pit orchestra that really was not trained to play rock and roll. It was a new kind of music, so they had charts and everything. And my father hired a drummer and said, look, just hit the backbeat and I'll turn my guitar up on 10, because these guys are just inconsequential. There's oboes, there's cellos, and there's flutes, and, you know, trying to keep up. And there is a recording that was done, I think, in Stockton, England in 57, and you kind of hear them, you know, limping along behind him, and my dad just drowning them out, you know, with Tutti Frutti and Long Tall Sally and, you know, things like that. It's fun. It's fun to go back and hear that stuff. It really is.
Well, you know,
what an experience for him.
What's interesting to me is, of course, he recognized early on what a big hit he was in Great Britain, but at that time, I doubt he understood what influence he really had, because later, the stories started to come out about the guy who actually had a cigarette butt in a baggie.
Yeah, Graham Nash was in my dad's. These were all young lads at the time. They were aspiring musicians, maybe 14 or 15 years old. They were sitting in his audiences in these old English theaters. Graham Nash, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Van Morrison, Eric Clapton. I mean, there's a long list of them. Peter Noon. And, of course, years later, my father had no idea he was influencing anyone. Of course, at that time, you know, if you had spoken to my dad or the Everlys, they thought that, well, this is a fad, and maybe in 4 or 5 years, you know, we'll have to get real jobs, you know, working in an office or pumping gas, whatever. But, you know, rock and roll was here to stay, as Danny and the Juniors proclaimed. And years later, you know, my father went back over there. He found out that these guys, they had a great reverence for him. And it's a wonderful thing. I mean, I think he really got a kick out of that. He was humbled by it, I think, too. But it was really quite a kick to him to know that these folks that went on to become superstars and make a ton of money, good for them. You know, they made up for the injustices that occurred during the late 50s and early 60s with some of the other artists. But it was a kick for him to learn that. And actually to meet some of these folks. My father recorded with Graham Nash and Paul McCartney covered Fabulous, and Sir Cliff Richard covered Fabulous, mm-hmm. and Butterfly most recently. And it's quite a thing. And I got to meet Sir Paul myself back in when was it? My dad wrote a book in 2015 called Rock and Roll's Hidden Giant with John Jackson.
Uh-huh.
He's also the biographer of Alan Freed.
You may recall. Yeah, right, and Bandstand.
And and this book is still available, by the way. You know, shameless plug here on Amazon. It's through Alfred Music Publishing. Rock and Roll's Hidden Giant: The Story of Rock Pioneer Charlie Gracie. And Paul McCartney actually endorsed it and wrote in the foreword along with Cliff Richard and then Graham Nash and a few others. When this book came out, Paul came into Philadelphia and played at the Wells Fargo Center, I think in 2015, it's Father's Day, and we were invited to the show. We were in the first row, but before the show, we met with him backstage, and Paul comes, you know, walking into, you know, behind the stage and going, dun, 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 the bass line that opens up to Fabulous.
Right.
Charlie, and my dad started laughing and gave him a big embrace, and we took pictures of him holding the book, and just a great thing. And I'm standing there watching, thinking, I'm pinching myself and thinking, is this really happening? You know, and I'm just so grateful that I had a chance to be a part of this and witness mm-hmm. this. And my dad certainly was thrilled to death, you know, and was very honored. Look, Raul, you know, we lost him. It's heartbreaking for us. We're having our moments. My mom turned 82, as a matter of fact, today.
Oh,
and we took her out
to
dinner tonight and try to make the best of it. But, you know, mm-hmm. we feel my dad's absence. But she had him. He lived 86 years. He was married to my mom for 64. Great marriage, you know, through thick and thin. Mm-hmm. They stuck it out, and we're still very much in love. And then my father got to play music for 71 years. You know, here, near and far,
right.
making people happy all over the world, performing music, which he loved to do. That I really believe that's why God put him on this earth, to entertain people. And he did it well, and it was his joy. Like I said, it didn't matter whether it was 50 people in some Irish pub or 2,000 people at a music festival in Lugano, Switzerland, or in London, or wherever he would be going. I mean, my dad always said, look, I played the best, and I played the worst, and everything in between.
Yeah. Well,
and
right.
he always gave 100%. He always did. Whatever, 100% of whatever he had that night, he gave it, even to the end.
Absolutely.
So,
and
we're blessed. We're blessed. As sad as it is to lose.
Yeah, of course. What paid off is your dad, unlike most of his peers, never had to go out and get a day job.
He wasn't found on the doorstep. I mean, he came up through the ranks. My father was already performing and entertaining at the age of 15, 16, 17, while still going to school. Yeah, in some places, actually illegally. My father's manager, Bernie Rothbard, who was with him for 36 years on a handshake, talk about a great marriage, if you will. So he walked into Carol's Star Bar. I think it was 52nd and Walnut in West Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
It was a strip club. And he said, kid, what are you doing here? And he said, how old are you? And my dad's like, 17, but don't say. He's like, I got to pull you out of here. He's like, first of all, you don't belong in here. But you know, he went wherever he could,
sure,
you know, wherever there was work,
absolutely,
just to kind of, you know, to cut his teeth. And so when his shot came, Raleigh, he was ready. And if you read the reviews, like from the London Hippodrome, it's 57 and 58. They're like, this kid really has stage presence. You know, a lot of them were just audacious amateurs, but he was poised and knew how to play. And he was, you know, he was quite proficient on the guitar and. Made an impression on the guys that came after him. So he could play with an orchestra, with a band, or by himself. It didn't matter. He could entertain the people, bottom line. And he knew how to create fun for the folks. And that's why they kept coming back. You know,
quite proficient on the guitar is an absolute understatement, as anybody who has seen Charlie live, because in most of his shows he will do some guitar work.
You
yes,
did many times.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so glad you did.
Oh, me too. And his guitar work was just amazing, because that stuff never really came out on the records, because of course it was a different venue entirely. But you know, unlike guys who, you know, took three lessons in the Chet Atkins course, your dad could absolutely play, you know, a 12 string or what have you. It didn't matter. Your dad could do it. And you know, you talk about his live appearances. I remember at the Reno Hilton, he played with Van Morrison, and I think even a CD. And when Paul McCartney had recorded Fabulous, I remember your dad telling me that he said, "I hope you wrote it, Charlie." And of course, Charlie had to say, "Nope, that
it's a shame. You could have made some money."
Exactly. That's That's so true. But
well, I'll tell you what, Raleigh. When APCO released the box sets, yep. not only my dad but like Dee Dee and Bobby and
sure.
Chubby and all the my father made more money on the ABCO re-releases in the early 2000s than he did when the records were on the charts. I mean, Jody Klein said to my father, look, Charlie, you know, this time around we're going to make sure you get what you deserve. My dad was like, yeah, well, whatever. You know, I don't even care if I get paid at this point. Just put the things out. It'll be part of my legacy. No. Whatever we sell, you're going to get your hunk. And I'll tell you what, when the first royalty checks came in, maybe 4, 5, 6 months later, my dad looked at the checks and said, I think I'm going to call ABCO in New York and make sure this is right. I don't want to cash these unless I know it's for real. And he called, and Jody said, no, it's your money. You keep it, you know. And they're still coming, and they're still trickling in even to this day. So it's wonderful. They kept their word, and we remain pretty close with Jody and Terry Landy up there in New York, who won a Grammy for her work with, I think, a Rolling Stones release a few years ago. And they were very, very fair and quite nice to him and supported him, I think, and rooted for him and came out to his shows.
Right,
when my dad played in New York, they were there. They were there.
And I'm so glad they righted the wrongs, because as much as your dad was wronged, what happened to the later acts when they refused to license material was just criminal. And, you know, I've always felt it was their act of the producers that Alan B. Klein probably sold, you know, 9 million% and couldn't start having, you know, royalties and stuff. But whatever it was, the Bobby Rydells and the Orlons and everybody else, the Dovells, made nothing because they wouldn't license. And I know that
all those years they were left in the dark and they could have used those songs for commercials. And,
a lot
of those cameo tunes were catchy numbers, you know, the songs by the Orlons and Rydell. And Chubby and Dee Dee and
absolutely.
You know, all the Dovells. Let's face it. I mean, you know, the cameo. Bernie Lowe may not have been fair with the almighty dollar, but my dad always said, "Look, he was a genius in the studio. Yeah. The man knew how to cut a record." My father had great respect for him, and I think, and my dad always actually liked him. And you know, it's funny. I think in late '63, it would have been '64 when the Beatles broke. My father got a call from Bernie Lowe. Just before he gave up cameo, his health was in decline. And he's like, Charlie, goes, you know, let's let bygones be bygones. I want to bring you back into the studio. I think I want to cut you like a Johnny Rivers or something like that. And I said, yeah, Bernie, whatever you want. And then, of course, then his health really declined, and then that was it. He had some sort of a spell. I think it was Parkinson's or something. And then that was it. He was out of circulation. That never happened. But at least they made their peace. And my dad never wished him any ill. He's like, you know, it happened. And you know, I made the decision to file a lawsuit, and I felt I was being treated unfairly, and it happened. You can't go back and erase it. Who knows?
No.
If he hadn't done that, maybe my father would have had 10 or 20 hits with cameo and not 3 or 4.
But
he was principled.
Around that time, he did have a record out on Diamond, and that was a Jerry Ross production.
Yeah,
so
Jerry Ross was great. Jerry Ross had a cutter record, too.
Yeah,
and we lost Jerry maybe 6, 7 years ago, I want to say.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we'll play a sample
of life is closing.
You bet.
On that whole generation. It is.
So, but, in fact,
great producer.
Yes.
Jerry was great.
Well, we'll play some of that Diamond record coming up next here on WGN Radio. WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. Yep, Diamond Records, 1965, Charlie Gracie and Jerry Ross. Joe Renzetti and Charlie Gracie wrote it, and Jerry produced it. And 1965, and it went nowhere. And Diamond was a little label that had some success, but not a major by any means. But nonetheless, I had expected more from that record than we got, didn't you?
Yes, well, was that Charlie Gracie or the Bo Brummels?
Yeah, on Autumn. Yeah, I know. Well, yeah. it sort of by months predated all that Bo Brummel stuff. So,
there you go. Well, yeah. And Joe Renzetti, of course, won an Academy Award for the scoring of the Buddy Holly story.
Oh, and did so much more. So it was truly record royalty on that.
Great.
Now, if you'll hang around for next hour, I definitely want to talk about Jamboree, because that's I always call that the world's first payola movie because of all the disc jockeys that featured in it. And to this day, we don't know what the dreaded disease was, but I've always wondered. But we'll talk about that. Now, John had said you had sent me an email, which I didn't get, with current stuff. So I'm sorry I didn't get it.
Yeah, well, if you want to go on YouTube, my father actually 2 years ago released his last single called Can't Stop Rockin'. And most people that heard this record said, we can't believe this is an 84-year-old man doing this number. But he did. You can probably go on YouTube and pull it off.
I will.
And then in 2012, my father released a song called Baby Doll, which actually scored on the... I have to check my references on this. It actually charted in the Hot 100 on the media based chart or something. I have to look for that.
All right.
And it got a lot of airplay around the country, and actually on the BBC too. So both of those are pretty hot numbers for a man in his late 70s, early 80s. People took him for maybe in his 40s when they heard the recordings.
Oh yeah. Well, I want to hear that. So I'll find
Baby Doll
next.
Can't Stop Rocking.
Yeah. Okay. And I also want to play one of the Roulette singles, because that was another amazing story too. So lots to go as we talk about Charlie Gracie with Charlie Gracie Jr. right here on WGN Radio. WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, and yes, that is Charlie Gracie, sounding as good as ever, and not a surprise at all, Charlie Jr., because as we were saying, your dad was touring almost every day of his life. I mean, so wouldn't surprise me at all.
A song certainly emblematic of the man, Can't Stop Rocking.
Yeah.
I think that's Gary Lefkowitz, one of the songwriters. Actually, that was produced by a gentleman. Gary Lefkowitz was Chubby Checker's musical director for a number of years, and then he did a couple things with my dad, including Baby Doll back in 2012, which actually charted around the country on the media-based charts, I believe.
Uh-huh.
But, my dad always played, so, I mean, people would say, did your dad ever practice? Has he ever realized? I said, no, he doesn't have to practice because he's always playing.
Well, that's right. He's practicing while he's playing. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I mean, there was no need to. But I think the pandemic, hit him and a lot of performers hard. He sat idle for about a year and a half. My dad wasn't one to pick up his guitar and just play around the house.
Right.
Like, if he changed his guitar strings, he would do it for maybe an hour or so to make sure they were where they should be and everything was tuned up. And, but he wasn't, he said it bored him to play for himself. My father needed an audience.
Yeah.
That was the key. They played off of each other, and he loved that. He loved that. Yeah.
Now, let me get to Jamboree, because, of course, as I say, my favorite movie, the world's only payola movie, with all these disc jockeys and all this kind of stuff. But that was before all the trouble with him saying, I might be due a royalty here. So I assume that everybody was on board on casting him. It had to be a trip working with all those people.
Yeah, my dad, I think, cut his spot for the movie with Jerry Lee Lewis. It wasn't filmed in California or in Hollywood. It was done at a studio in New York City.
Right.
And my dad and Jerry Lee were scheduled that day, and my father sang the movie sang the song Cool Baby in the movie, which was written by Otis Blackwell.
And it's a great song. In fact, of the Cameo Parkway stuff, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, and there's an alternate version of that, too. It's a little bit longer, a little bit different, and... it's a nice little tune. It's kind of short, but it's nice. It's got a nice fluffy feel to it.
Mm-hmm. It does. And I was surprised that didn't chart. But again, Cameo is still a young label and still dealing with distribution issues and all that kind of stuff. And of course, this is long before there's Chubby Checker and The Twist and everything else that really put them on the map. I mean, literally without Charlie, I think that Cameo would have gone under.
Well, he bankrolled the company. I mean, he helped them make their first big profits, and they were able to expand. And then you had Cameo Parkway by, what, 59 or 60. So, and as a matter of fact, Raleigh, at my dad's memorial mass last Friday, D.D. Sharp was there, and two members of the Times, Norman Burnett and Caesar Berry, were there. They're dear friends, and we keep in touch. And we love them. And, up until the time my father became ill, we get together for... meals and just go to a nearby diner or something and just kind of hang out and talk and shoot the breeze for a few hours and laugh and have fun and tell stories. And it was just great being around all of these folks. It's just a trip. To me, they're all superstars. I mean, I love them all. And whenever I have a chance to go and see them, I will. And I will continue to do so and promote them and help them along, whatever I can do. It's one big family here. But we're losing a lot of them.
Well, that's the thing. It really is the roots of rock and roll, no doubt about that. And just by virtue of the calendar, every day that goes by, you hear of another loss. Mm-hmm. And, you fast forward another decade, and it's over. Many people who would say that's true already, but there are still some vestiges. But another decade goes by, and that's it. And so
we lost Len Barry a couple of years ago. We lost Bobby Raydell last year too. In fact, my dad did a show with Bobby. My dad played Harris Hotel and Casino in Atlantic City in November of 21, and on that show was my father, Bobby Raydell, The Times, mm-hmm. The Dupree's, a few other groups. Their names escape me now, but Bobby was in a wheelchair. We were backstage and we were looking for Bobby, and I said, "That's Bobby." He says, "No." He said, "Charlie," said, "I can't walk anymore." He said, "I can stand for like one song, and then I have to sit because if I don't sit, I'll fall." Mm-hmm. But he still went out there like the trooper that he was. Those guys, my dad and Rydell and all those guys, my dad was more rock and roll, Bobby was more pop. But I mean, they were still raised during the old school showbiz, culture that you go out there and you entertain the people and the show must go on. You do the best you can. And he went out there and he did great. And little did we know that was going to be the last time that we saw him, because a few months later he was gone.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad we saw him during that show. Yeah.
Now, of course, your dad was inducted into the British Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That's been about 25 years ago now. And, of course, he's in the Rockabilly Hall of Fame. But I assume the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame still hasn't taken notice?
Well, it's funny. I got a call, I think 2 days after my father passed. Greg Harris, the president of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, called me from Cleveland. And my dad did they came to Philadelphia in 2018 for their annual retreat. Every year they choose a different city. 1 year Memphis, 1 year Philly. They came and they hired my father to perform. And there was also a lecture and a Q&A at the Barnes Foundation in Philly. And Dee Dee was there and the Times and the Dovells. And it was a great 4 days. And my father played. In fact, my father was backed by someone that I think would admire, Ben Vaughan, the Ben Vaughan Band.
Sure.
And they really kicked butt.
Good.
So my father left quite an impression that day. And he said, I wanted to have your father come out and do some shows at the Hall of Fame, but then the pandemic hit, and then we never got off the ground again for a while. But he said, "Charlie, here's what I want to do." He said, "Your father allowed me to hold that precious guitar of his, and that's really just a piece of artwork. It's like a piece of furniture, It's just it's amazing." He said, "I want to do this soon. So we'll talk after the holidays, and once you get by all this, the stuff you're dealing with now." He said, "I want to do a display on your dad at the Hall of Fame with his guitar. Do you have any old contracts from like the Ed Sullivan show and the Alan Freed shows?" I said, "Yes, sir, we have everything." He said, "We'll get all that stuff together." He said, "I'll be in touch, and we're going to do a display on your dad. I'm going to put it in a place of prominence so people can see it." So I'm waiting for a follow-up from Greg Harris, and I'll let you know where that goes. He said, well, I think if your dad, I think there's a, and I'm probably going to mess it up, but there's a famous quote that was uttered by Jackie Robinson, the first black ball, baseball player that broke the color line. Something about a life is only measured by what it leaves for others, or it's measured by what you give to others. And when I think of your father, I think of that because he said your father, you know, made everyone happy and joyful, and wherever he went, he was like the Pied Piper, and he left people happier because of his performances and his presence. And that's what I think of when I think of your dad. You know, that's his legacy. You know, besides the music itself, but the fact that he entertained people and made them happy. I thought, wow, that's really beautiful, Greg.
Well, so, yes, but it would be even more beautiful if they would induct him into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. None of the Philadelphia people have been inducted.
Oh,
so pretty,
I know.
Pretty,
well,
pretty,
you know, you look at
story.
A number of things, like Neil Sedaka's not in it, and
right.
On and on the list is. Yeah, it's...
But Raleigh, yet Dolly Parton was inducted.
Yeah, well, yes.
And she's like, I don't think I belong here.
Well, and, you know,
but who knows?
She didn't offend me as much as, you know, it's obviously Jan Wenner and the Rolling Stone take on what rock and roll is. I still say, I don't care what they say, Pat Boone belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Sure, because, he does.
You know,
absolutely.
Because if it weren't for him, general market kids would not have heard those records, the race records.
That's right.
Played. And, of course, the other thing that I say often is Randy Wood, who owned Dot Records, he was Randy's record shop. He's the guy who sponsored all the R&B on WLAC at night. And
okay,
he,
there you go.
You know, he knew firsthand, but he also knew he couldn't get it played in the day. So hence Dot, you know, he looked for Pat Boone, found a kid at Belmont College who looked the part and said, yeah, you're what I need. And to me, you know, people who were teens in the 50s, yeah, we can both talk about how Tab Hunter couldn't sing, but he had some number one records, and Pat Boone certainly did as well. So I don't want to have to.
Pat's records were pretty good.
Yeah, some of them were. Like I say, some of them were, and some of them were absolutely painful. But that's not not the subject. The subject is if it's a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and it's going to depict the era. I don't think you can do that by ignoring what you think doesn't qualify. And
the longer they wait, Raleigh, the less meaning it's going to have to actually
put
these people in, because later generations are not going to know who these people are.
Right.
You know, and
the people,
and
the people, like if your dad's inducted now, that's great, but he's not here to see it. And, that's just a
Well, you know, my dad never had an ego, Raleigh. No. He never was one to, that was my job. I was his alter ego. I used to brag about him. My father always said, Charlie Jr., you're a natural promoter. I wish I had you like 25 years ago back when I was a younger man. But, and if we had the computers back then too, like he could have done a lot of damage for me. But I enjoy it. You know, I was what Colonel Parker was to Elvis. I was to my dad, but I worked for free.
Right.
I didn't take 50% of the income.
Now,
it was a labor of love.
Are you still maintaining the website?
Oh, absolutely. And let me tell you something, Raleigh. I'm a school teacher, as you know, and one of my coworkers, his brother, is some sort of an administrator for Facebook, and he told me the other day, he said, tell Mr. Gracie Jr. that his father has had over 30,000 hits or references in the last 2 weeks on Facebook alone since his passing. That's quite a... Yeah, I don't know how they measure those things, but he told me that. I said, no, I'm telling you, this is what we're seeing. I'm like, wow. And the sentiments coming in from all over the world have just been a great comfort to us. Really, they have. And when I can bear it, I read them. And my mom is not, computer savvy, but I sat her down. I said, Mom, you have to read some of these things because they're just going to melt your heart. And they're beautiful. I mean, they traveled the world together, Raleigh. You know, mom was 17 when she married my dad, and they were on the road 6 weeks later. And in fact, they flew over with Pat Boone and Shirley Boone.
Right, I remember those pictures. And everybody
they were mobbed at the airport. There were a couple thousand kids there. And my mom was scared to death, a little, you know, shy girl off the streets of South Philly. It's like, whoa, what do I do? Where do I go? My dad said, just hang on to me, and wherever I go, just follow, you know.
Exactly.
And, it was a trip, a real trip for them.
Oh, sure,
but,
it was.
Yeah.
Sure, it was.
But she grew. I mean, my mom was a very shy person when she first met my dad, but she really blossomed and learned how to deal with all of that. And she has her own groupies too. People love her.
That's and as well they should. She deserves every bit of it.
Oh yeah, they're amazing. And she turned 82 this evening. She looks 25 years younger than what she. Well, my dad still looked pretty good for his age too. He looked about 20 years younger than what he was.
Absolutely.
Until he became ill, and I think the music kept him young. You know, it really did.
But I agree.
It was hard. These last few months were hard for him when he couldn't play anymore. And he's just sitting around. And he said to my mom, "You know, this might be my time." And like, "Dad, don't give up. Don't give up." And I think he tried more for us. But I think he knew. My dad was very stoic about death. He said, "You know, we all have our destiny and we all have our time. And mine will be here sooner or later. You know, I won't leave this earth a minute sooner or later than I'm supposed to." But he knew he had a good life. And I think he said, "I hate to leave you all. I don't want to leave you. But, you know, none of us are going to be here forever. We're all headed in the same direction, and it's just a matter of time." But he had a great life, and that comforts us. We're going to miss him. Our lives are forever altered, and will be empty. But we are just we're bolstered by the fact that we know that he had a wonderful life, and he was loved, and people appreciated him, he was basically a happy guy, you know, and overcame a lot. If you read the book, Rock and Roll, Sid and Giant, there's a lot. It's not only a book about the music industry, but it's about life, about family, about overcoming obstacles and poverty and, you know, and family conflicts and things of that. And there's so much in that book. It's really a Bible for life to kind of get through, you know, what life can sometimes toss at you and throw at you.
Yeah, I will get a link on Raleigh.net to that book. And I've got a couple more questions. I don't want to keep you all night, but I'm not done yet. And
I'm here. By the way, just to go back to Carl and Roulette real quick, you mentioned Dick Jacobs. Yes, when my father was signed by Carl in late 58, Dick did say that to my father after Buddy was killed, unfortunately. My dad loved Buddy Holly, by the way. Yeah. It's a big... Sure. I think my father never met Buddy nor Elvis, but I think the bigger disappointment for it was him that was not meeting Buddy, because I think my father appreciated Buddy's creativity. I mean, Buddy was a true musician.
Yes,
didn't have Elvis's looks and all the glamour, but my father appreciated what he did as a musician and would have loved to have met him, and then their paths never crossed. But Dick said, "Look, Buddy's gone. You know, you this is great. You're going to fill that void." But of course, you know, the cogs were already in place to keep him out.
Yes.
But he did cut a few good records with Carl. And if you notice, the Bobby Marchand and his band backed my father on a lot of those recordings, and a lot of the chorus or the same chorus used on my dad's Carl release is the same that Jackie Wilson used on his. You can hear the similarity in the voices, the backing voices.
Oh, that's
pretty
great.
Much the same crowd.
That's great.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Jackie was one. By the way, Raleigh, one more thing. My dad did some shows with Brooks Wilson, who was Jackie's son, and he does a great job. That weekend, we worked two shows with him. My dad's last two shows, he was on the bill. And in fact, they shared the dressing room together, he and Bobby Brooks Wilson. It was wonderful. He never knew his dad until later. His mom apparently kept that information from him until later. That's a story in itself.
Yes.
But, kudos to him going out there, keeping his dad's legacy alive and honoring his father. He was a great, great artist, Jackie Wilson, my God.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he was greater. He was greater.
Yeah, you betcha. All right, so we're going to pick it up. I've got, in fact, one of the Roulette records. It's one of my favorite, a little bit different for Charlie, but really nice. So I'll pick it up there right here on WGN Radio. I loved you. I cheated and lied. WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James, and as I say, a little different for Charlie Gracie, but I thought it was a great little record, and Charlie co-wrote it, and it was on Roulette, which is what sparked my interest, because, of course, sadly, the whole debacle with Cameo and not getting royalties that led to literally him being banned in the United States. I'm thinking, and then he's on Roulette, because I think if you had a list, the king of individuals who didn't pay royalties, Moish Levy, owner of Roulette, was at that very top of that. So, of course, it wasn't a hit, so it became a moot point. But I got to find out how that happened. And we will with Charlie Gracie Jr. on WGN Radio.
Chwop, 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 coo. Chwop, 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 coo.
I love to hold you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I'll never scold you. Mm-hmm. Please don't cry. Well, I won't lie. You're really my cool baby. Cool baby. You make my heart sing. Yeah. You say some sweet things. I swear it's true, I really do. I go for you. Cool baby, cool baby. Can't you tell that this was meant to be? I can tell that you were meant for me. Your crazy walk, yeah, 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 makes me
WGN Radio, I'm Raleigh James, and yes, Charlie Gracie, and that was on Cameo, and as I was saying earlier, that was in Jamboree, which you can see that probably the whole movie online, and it's a kick to watch. Yeah. But so I got to ask, Charlie Jr., when I noticed your dad had been on Roulette, I was thinking to myself, well, this is the oddest pairing I've ever seen, because as I was saying, Moish Levy never paid anyone any royalties. So what were they both thinking?
Very true. Well, I think Joe Reisman, who was my dad's A&R man on Roulette, and I believe he may have set the deal with Roulette in 1960-61.
Yeah.
And my dad met Moish Levy a few times. You know, if you met the guy, you'd fall in love with him.
Yes.
Great. He'd take you out to dinner.
Yes.
He'd shower you with love and affection.
Yes.
And, you know, spend $1,000 on a dinner with you and your partner, but you know, he wouldn't pay royalties. So,
yeah.
But, you know, my dad at that point was just tickled to be on Roulette and be releasing, new singles, because, you know, he had fallen flat after leaving Cameo. It was kind of like, at this point, you know, swinging and missing and trying to connect. And so, hey, Roulette's a major label. Yeah, sure as hell I'll sign with them and give it a shot. You know, my dad actually recorded a song written by Hal David and Burt Bacharach on Roulette 2 called I Look For You.
Wow.
Nice little song.
I'll look for that. I do not have that.
Yeah.
I'll look for that.
Yeah, it's a nice tune. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And, I think he did three singles
on Roulette.
Yeah. And three on and Carl, yeah.
Yeah.
And then he went to some lesser labels like Selfsted and Diamond and Sock and Soul in the middle, the middle late 70s, you know.
Sure.
He was still plugging away and trying to change with the musical styles to get a hit and get back, you know, on the charts again. But it was tough, you know. Some of those records, some of them were so-so, and some were actually pretty good. Some of those singles were pretty good.
It was also very, very tough in the latter 60s because the dance shows were over.
Right.
Rock and roll had gone very hard for the most part. And, you know, it just wasn't conducive. And so a lot of performers, that's exactly when they washed out. They were lucky if they got a lounge gig somewhere, but they weren't headlining anything. And for many of them, they didn't trog through it to get to the other side, where, of course, when the rock and roll oldies revival happened in the 70s, it was just wonderful. But people forget that there was at least half a decade there where you couldn't get arrested.
Right. So my dad resorted to playing, clubs and lounges and playing down at the Jersey. He played out at the Jersey Shore, like Atlantic City and Wildwood.
Sure.
Places like Avalon along the Jersey coast for a number of years. It was a mainstay down there.
Right.
There's one particular place called Moore's Inlet.
Of course.
It was a club that existed from the 40s. I think Bill Haley and the Comets played there early in their careers, too. And he played there 25 straight summers, my dad did, on an outdoor open patio facing the ocean.
In North Wildwood.
He made it. he made a good living. They named a street after him down there, Charlie Gracie Boulevard, by the Bolero, which was like one of the leading clubs at the time.
Sure.
And, so he, you know, that's how we survived. And, you know, my father could play any kind of music, so he was comfortable with younger crowds, older crowds, ethnic crowds. During the lean years, you adapt, and he actually became a better performer.
Right.
Because a lot of guys couldn't make that adjustment. They could play their hits or play the things that they knew, but you know, my dad could do swing, he could do country, he could do instrumentals, he could do jazz, so anything. And you become a versatile performer, and that's how he survived. He never had to get another gig. You know, 71 straight years in the music business, from when he made Boogie Woogie Blues in 51 through this past year, actually.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, And you're right. During those years, the people who survived it were people who became entertainers. And the room might have been smaller, and it might have been the secondary club or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that intimacy gave rise to needing to relate one-on-one to that audience and making that connection. And your dad was great at that, because part of that was your dad was a good guy. I don't know anybody who has an unkind word to say about Charlie Gracie who knew him, period. I've never heard it.
Ben Vaughn sent us a video the other day and posted it on my dad's Facebook site. He said, "This man have any enemies?"
No.
He did. Like, I'd like to meet them and know how or why. But I agree. I mean, my father, again, because, you know, my father was not about the BS, as you know, Raleigh, and wouldn't stand for it. He went out there. He did what he did. I'm here to entertain the people. And if you like me, that's wonderful. If you don't, that's okay.
Right.
But this is who I am. This is what I do. He was self-possessed.
Yeah.
And had been through a lot. And so, you know, he held his head up and went out and did the best he could. And, it was never about him. My father said that the one thing used to annoy him about some of his peers in the business, especially the bigger ones, like, you know, they would show up at a performance and they would do things that they would perform for themselves. Like, they weren't there to perform for the audience. You know, they had this kind of snobbish attitude. Well, I don't want to do Brown Eyed Girl. I don't want to do. I want to do what I want to do. You know, but people want to hear your hits. That relates to their youth and when they're growing up. And you got to make the people happy. My father did whatever the people wanted. It wasn't about him. It was about them. And I think that's why he was loved. It was never about him. It was always about them.
Yeah, and just having a good time. It was as simple as that.
Having a good time, and, you know, and it's funny. Somebody wrote on Facebook last week, and I thought this was very clever, but very true. They said Charlie Gracie didn't have fans. He had friends.
Yes.
And because he became, you know, friends with all his fans. Even when I read the postings from Europe, it's like we felt part of the family. We felt he led us in the dressing room when he came out. He came out and spoke to, if you ever saw my dad play the clubs, when he got done his set, you might do like three or four sets, and then in between sets, he would go out onto the floor and go from table to table and shake hands and post pictures and just talk small talk with the people. And people love that.
They love it.
And that's what keeps them coming back. They feel like they're part of you and you're part of them.
Yeah.
And it was a beautiful thing. Really, it was. And it paid off. He wasn't doing it, I think, to be calculating, but that's just who he was.
Of course.
You know, the people are here to see me, and I'm going to go out and I'm going to spend time with them rather than go back in some room and, you know, and rest or get away from. He always made himself accessible. And my mom would sometimes say, "Why don't you go take a rest? Go sit down, get off your feet." No. This is why I'm here. This is what I love, and I want to go out and see the people and thank them. And they appreciated it. They really did. And they still do.
Absolutely, they do. No, anybody who has been to a Charlie Gracie show won't forget it. As far as that goes, it's just a great a great time. Yeah. Now, I got to ask a little about you. Are you still teaching?
I am. You know, for 21 years, I taught juvenile offenders, my own private Blackboard jungle.
Yes. No, you did. And, you know, I mean, that is such a calling. And there are few people who can gain the respect of these kids. And we're talking some of the worst offenders. And I'll tell you right now, Charlie Gracie Jr. commanded respect from every last one of them. You know, you did a marvelous job, and it was so rare.
Well, yeah, your heart goes out to them. And some of these kids are, you know, the quote-unquote bad kids. You know, if you had the upbringing that some of these kids have had and have suffered through, you almost can't blame them for doing the things they did, because they're angry, they feel unloved, they feel like they have no purpose. And I'm not making excuses for them, but you can understand it. So I went in there. You know, it's funny, I kind of adopted my dad's, you know, take on this. You go in, you be yourself. you know, they knew if I was off. Generally, I went in pretty happy and upbeat, and I was going to make them feel important. Like, I'm here for you. And you know, it's funny, right? I taught 20th century American history, and when we got to the period of rock and roll and pop culture, I mean, look at the references I had to draw from. I would bring my father, and I would bring Dee Dee Sharp, and I would bring the Times. They all came in.
Yeah.
And I said, look, you guys and gals, these people were the superstars of their age. And I would show them the old videos, and they would answer questions. And you know, Dee Dee came in for me one day and spent the entire day. I thought she was going to fall over exhausted. How do you do this? She said, I need another Pepsi. Yeah. Give me some caffeine. But she stayed the whole day. And you know, my dad did this a few times, and the kids would say, you know, we don't get this on our regular schools. You're going out on a limb to make it happen for us here in this building. And I said, well, you know, and plus I'm having fun with it too. I want to have fun with it. I want to make my job enjoyable for me. So it just kind of goes hand in hand. And I think they respected that.
Yeah.
You know, and I enjoyed it. I really, really did. And there were no rules because these are the kids that fall into the cracks. So it's like, do anything you can to keep them engaged. And so that's what I would do. You know, bringing people from all walks of life. And then, you know, with the pandemic hit, unfortunately, and they stopped sending us kids to our building, and then we were down to like maybe half a dozen kids when they started lifting the sanctions. And so we were told by our employers that, look, you know, we can't keep three or four veteran teachers at the top of the pay scale when you only have four or five kids in the building. So I was actually transferred to something called the Brandywine Virtual Academy. I'm online with students now every day, and I get to work from home. I work 4 days a week, and two out of the four I'm home on my computer. I have 160 kids. It's like I have office hours. If they have any trouble with their studies, everything's online. They can call me. They can text me. I correct their tests. I grade their essays, and I'm always on standby if they need me. And that's my job now. So it was a major, major change. The first year I was rather depressed because I was used to the interaction with the kids, and it's like, oh, this is terrible. I'm going to have to quit maybe after a year. But then we changed. We have a new education app now called Buzz, and it's more interactive with the kids. And so I hear from them. I interact with them more. Who doesn't mind? Who doesn't like working from home?
Well, you know, absolutely.
I know you can appreciate that.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what. I sure wish they had that kind of thing when I was going to school. I would have hopped on that bandwagon in a New York minute. Now, in this case, is it still like part of the Chester County Intermediate Union unit?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
All right.
Yeah, the Brandywine Virtual Academy is an annex to the IU building.
Okay.
And, it was experimental for a number of years. But this is the wave of the future, Raleigh, they tell me. So I'm 64 years old. I'm not a kid anymore myself. And thank God I've inherited my parents' energy and vigor. I have all that going for me. So I can out ADD these kids, you know.
Yeah, right.
But really, I can't. So I was thinking of retiring, but I said, you know, why should I? I'm enjoying it. I can work from home. I'm in a quiet, safe environment. It's nice, and I'm still helping kids, and I can kind of, you know, put my imprint on it, you know, my personal imprint on what I do, and I do the best I can, and so I'm going to continue until they get sick of me and tell me to not come back anymore.
Well,
I
think they won't do that, but then when you turn 70, of course, good old Pennsylvania, you'll be out, but
right.
You know, it's
right.
The mandatory right. retirement, but until then, I don't think they'll let you go. So that's really interesting, because when we talk about intermediate units, very often these are the troubled kids in many ways, and to
right.
be able to
school.
And to be able to reach them at a distance, that's got to be an art.
Well, yeah, and you know, my wife Kim and I, we actually took in two former juvenile offenders. Unfortunately, neither of them are with us anymore because they had drug problems. But when they were living under our roof with us, they never violated our trust. They never robbed us or did mm-hmm. anything, you know, that we would regret. I mean, and unfortunately, a lot of these kids start on drugs when they're 11 and 12 and 13 years
right.
of age, and then even in their 20s, I mean, the physiology of the brain has changed, and they always had that desire to go back. If there's something, if they get depressed or a roadblock hits them, the first thing they reach for is the substances again, and it's hard for them to give it up when the brain is used to that kind of thing. So, but, you know, it was an experience. I don't have any children. I got married late in life. Kim and I have been married. It'll be 17 years come.
Yeah.
Well, actually, on the 14th. It's coming up. Yeah. So, of January. So, you know, we, It was quite an experience. I learned a lot. I thought I knew a lot about addiction, and you know, but I didn't. You know, it's not a matter of willpower. These kids are really, really. It's a terrible tragedy, and we cried a lot of tears for both of them because we loved them. They were like our sons. But and I'm so close with the families, and we keep in touch, and. Maybe I'll write a book someday.
I hope you will. I hope you will, because while it's not as flamboyant as somebody who's going to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it's certainly of that same giving of yourself to others that was, you know, the hallmark of your dad. So
my parents always taught us that. You know, just be who you are and no pretensions, and you go out there. I was just a real, the quote of being a real person, just going out there And if I don't know the answer, I don't know the answer. Or if I'm having a bad day, I'm having a bad day. And kids want to see that. They don't want to see sunshine and lollipops all day. They want to know that you're human and you have down times too. And I would tell them sometimes I come in here and I don't really feel like being here because there's things going on in my personal life. Maybe I'm not feeling well or somebody in my family's struggling. But you come in, you're professional, you rise above it. You're here. Your needs are my needs when I come in here at 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning. So I have to switch my focus from my problems to yours. And that's why I'm being paid, and that's my calling, and that's what we do. Sure. So not just me, but there's a lot of other great folks in our field too. You know, there are lousy folks in all
of course,
doctors and nurses, whatever, teachers. But for the most part, to stay in that field, you've got to love it, and you've got to feel called for it. Otherwise, you'll never make it. You know, you'll be gone in 2 or 3 years. You'll burn out very quickly.
Absolutely. Well, it's been far too long, and again, I'm so saddened for the reason that we're talking, but I'm so grateful we are, and I hope you'll stay in better touch.
We will, Raleigh. And listen, I want to thank you. I mean, you were very good to my dad when he was alive. You had him on your shows many times, came to many of his performances. We miss you in the Philadelphia area. Like I said, we are poor for having lost you in 2006. But and you're always welcome to come back.
Oh, no, I'd love to. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm with you in spirit. That's for sure. And love to your mom. And
she sends her love to you, too.
You know, I'm not a Facebook denizen. I know John says you're on that. I'm not. But you've got my email address, so I want you to be in my inbox more often than not.
Absolutely. I promise.
All right, Charlie
and
Gracie.
If you post it on anything that's coming up, I'll let you know what's
please
happening.
Please do. Please do. And I'll get a link to the book and the website and the 2018 single. All right, Charlie. Thank you for talking to us.
Blessings to you both. And
all right. All right, good
deal.
So Charlie Gracie Jr. Yes, and of course, we'll wind up coming back with 99 Ways. You knew I was going to close with that. All right, all that and more for moments here on WGN Radio.
99 Ways, take 11.
There must be 99 ways for losing the blues that I forgot from loving. 99 ways, but none of them do. There must be 99 ways to do without you, but I can't find one tonight. I'm feeling so bad, and nothing is right. Baby, I'm missing your hug and a kiss, and I'm as lonely as can be. Would I try all the others, but none of the others can do what's due to me. There must be 99 ways for losing the blues that I forgot from loving you. 99 ways, but I still love you. 99 ways for losing the blues that I've got from loving you. 99 ways, but none of them do. There must be 99 ways to do without you, but I can't find one tonight. I'm feeling so bad and nothing is right. Oh baby, I'm
I'm a missing your hugging and a kiss that I'm a
WGN Radio. I'm Raleigh James. Well, it's a good thing we're coming to the end of the show. I've just spilled a bottle of water and some equipment, so I've got my work cut out for me. But you know, the nice thing about it is it won't take 21 hours to fix that. And tomorrow night we've got a full show, and that full show includes Julie Ryan. Yeah. And in the first hour, and she's a medical intuitive and a psychic and an all-around great person, and I'm going to hog her the first part of the show, because last month when she was on, she did readings for you guys, and while that was fun, I want to get to the heart of what she's all about, because unlike a lot of people who come to the psychic world with impressions from childhood and, you know, all these stories about that, she actually learned this, and the fact that you can learn it, I think, is just fascinating. So we'll talk a little about that, and then final 2 hours, it's pretty much whatever's on your mind, it'll be on mine. People ask, when's Marianne coming back? Marianne Winkowski, the Ghostbuster, will be here Thursday, January 19th. And yeah, the nice thing about that is that if you think there's perhaps some ghost activity around you, well, if you call from where you think you're haunted, she can let you know exactly what's there. And she is the real deal. It's fascinating. And then, of course, not my show, but this Saturday, Stephen Johnny. Yeah, 9 p.m. to 2 a.m., five big hours on WGN. So that should be a lot of fun. So plenty of things to keep you busy in the next couple days. Chubby Tavares retired December 30th. Yeah, health issues, I'm sorry to say, so keep him in your prayers. And of course, Tavares, one of my all-time favorite groups. Beyond that, I'm looking at additional segments to come up, and I know I promised Tommy on the South Side we'd do the Velvelettes, and we will. And I promised Mary in Milwaukee and Renard in Naperville we'd do Jackie Wilson, and of course we'll play Higher and Higher. You know, that'll happen. And a Gene Chandler segment? Yeah, I understand he was on WGN around New Year's weekend. Yeah, I haven't been able to get him on my show. Right, I guess I don't rank, but his music sure does, and we'll be playing that. And we'll do a Sam Cooke segment, and no, of course he won't be there. But Manhattans, Karen wants the Manhattans, and you don't have to twist my arm for that either. So plenty of things to talk about. And if there's, you know, basically I consider this to be your show. So if there's something you would like to hear or something you'd like us to discuss, providing it has absolutely no significance whatsoever. That's right. If it's important, you got to get it somewhere else. That's right. You are not going to hear what is happening in the House of Representatives, although I will say maybe that's not politics. It might have just turned into entertainment, but either way, we will avoid the topic. But other than the state of the world at large, it's all up for grabs. So 888-876-5593, write it down, call, participate, and don't forget Raleigh.net, Rolly.net, because all the bumpers and the show information is there after every show. So until tomorrow night, 21 hours from now, we thank Dan for keeping us on the air, John for screening your calls, you especially for calling. I'm Raleigh James. That's a wrap. It's WGN Radio.